Welcome everyone to Programming Languages. Today we are going to continue on last time's topic, transactional memory, and we're now going to treat implementations of transactional memory in languages. So there's two variants for doing that. First of all, there's software transactional memory. This has been a topic of research for the with the kind of most practical impact for the last 30 years due to, not so much hardware support actually available. This has changed in the recent years with the upcoming hardware implementations of transactional memory, and we'll see how they compare in a little bit of time. So let's just start with software transactional memory. So with software support for transaction, what you usually see in practical systems is that there is some kind of logical clock implemented in the form of some kind of version counter. So what you usually do is in those systems that you associate each variable or address that you somehow access in your program with the clock value for the last write that this particular address has seen. So for that you usually keep a central facility that keeps track of the current logical time. And then you usually have, apart from a few management areas in memory, you have particular wrapper methods that you use every time that the a variable is read or written. And in these wrapper methods are supposed to be placed around locations in your program where you do a write or read on a particular variable, and they either update the management data structures for the example of a write. So usually you put the value of the logical clock that is currently active as the new version for that particular address in your management data structures, and for a read you somehow, in case that you are doing a transaction at the moment, you will try to verify that the version that you read is compatible with all the other variables that you have seen so far, and do that usually by comparing them to the clock value that was the most recent one at the start of your transaction. So what all that means is that you need to, in order to realize those blocks that we have introduced, those atomic blocks, usually would implement them in high-level code, in the sense that you would again implement them as a block, but you would add a few things to these blocks. For example, you will initialize your current transaction with a call to this start transaction method, and you will then try to execute the transaction in the area that follows. So this is the place where you would place the transaction's code, and then you would try to, in the end, commit the transaction. And if the transaction turns out to be valid, then the system would commit, and the return value would communicate to the while loop that it's okay to exit now. And in case that the transaction was invalid, then we would repeat the whole thing, try to set up a new transaction, and try to go through the transaction once again. During the actual code, the one that is placed here, we will not just do a plain copy of the code from the atomic block, but we would annotate each of the read and write accesses in that code with our callback methods for read and write, which would then do the necessary comparisons of the logical versions of the things that are used there. So, yeah, well, that is kind of, once again, what I've already tried to tell you. So, usually in the software TM implementations, you have several design options how to implement your actual transaction logic. So what you can do is, for example, you have a design choice for when the actual writes are performed in memory. So the two approaches to that would be the undo log or the redo log, and they differ in the actual timing when the changes to memory are actually communicated to the memory. So in an undo log, what you would do is you would eagerly write the changes to the memory with the need of undoing the changes that you have done in case that the transaction fails. And the other choice would be a redo log approach, where you would kind of buffer all the changes that you do to main memory until you reach the point where usually the transaction would be committed, and you would do all the changes at once. So you kind of postpone the actual storing of your such that the other transactions can see them. The other choice that you have is the way of actual keeping track of what you have done so far with, for example, these read and write sets, where you just keep track of which locations you have accessed so far, or whether you do that with read or write versions by checking timestamps when a value was accessed. And as we have already indicated before, a lot of the implementations that are out there do this kind of timestamp based thing together with a redo log. So that is also a thing that one of the approaches that I want to highlight here does. This was one of the research prototypes for how general software transactional memory could be implemented. This was this TL2 system, and this would be a system that supports, for example, our fancy property opacity, so that in such a system like this TL2, the intermediate state during the transaction is never observed by other transactions, be they failing or not. So for that, well, that is something that usually hints the direction of something like a redo log. So you don't actually ever publish your changes to the memory until the very end, where you do to try to do that with an exclusive access to the memory. So that is something that goes together. It also uses so-called lazy versioning. So the writes are stored in the redo log and only performed when it's, well, when you cannot circumvent that you at some point have to do something about writing. And it does so-called validating conflict detection. So at the point where you actually try to perform the modification of a particular address, and this turns out to be not a valid operation, then the whole thing aborts. So this is achieved with the idea of a global counter, which is obtained on the start of a transaction, and then this transaction version is used later on to validate whether the versions of memory that we then further on try to access are still well consistent with that global counter. And in case that we reach the end of our transaction, we will then update the global counter and publish the new versions of variables together with new version numbers that correspond to the updated global counter. So what does that mean for the involved methods? So there is the transactional read from some particular offset of an object. What you do is then that you compare the version of the memory that you're reading from, how that relates to the transaction. If the version of the object is younger than the transaction, then there must have been an update in the time between the transaction has started and your read has been performed. So that usually means that this has been accessed from somewhere else. So you can't, since you only keep track of a general notion of when you access something and not kind of the history of that, you will in general just say, well, that is a cause for aborting your transaction. And also you you will be vulnerable with respect to the commit phases of other transactions. So these are usually in the software transactional memory done by locked critical sections. So what you will usually also look out for is whether the object that you read from is currently locked, because that indicates that they are in process of being rewritten, and that is usually also a source for a conflict, so you will in that case also abort. In case that there's no reason for aborting, you will usually return the value read or found in memory and add the accessed memory to your read set, which you're going to use later on in order to verify whether the read version has remained the same at the point where you in the end then commit your transaction. The write of a transaction is much simpler. You just enter the new value together with the address in the redo log for later committing to memory at the end of the transaction. So this leaves the commit of the transaction to be open. So what that does is that will pick up locks for the written objects in order to make sure that no other transaction will collide with yours when it writes to memory objects. Then there will be an increment to the global version, and a check whether the objects that you have put into the read set are still up to date, in the sense that they are still older or as old as the version of the transaction. So if they have not changed in between start of the transaction and the commit by now, then you can assume that you have been working on a consistent state and perform your changes on the main memory and release the locks. So that is how these systems usually work. So they have these kind of phases where the first phase is started with a start transaction, where you perform reads and writes, and during that time the memory the globally accessible memory remains kind of consistent, and at the point in time where you try to commit, then there's a phase where the global memory is modified, and this is usually done in a locked fashion, where you then do this increment, validate, and write that we have described earlier on. So there's of course a few consequences of that, particularly that although the whole system looks like this very idealistic form of atomic blocks, during the commit phase you still require having these locks. So this is not a lock-free thing. So in principle, deadlocks are still possible if you don't do any fancy stuff in with respect to like ordering the locks that you acquire for these commit phases. And well, that is something that you might be able to resolve by beforehand. Well, if you know the complete system of all the transactions that might happen, which you usually do, or well, you can at least imagine that you have systems where you do so, and these systems you can upfront try to calculate an order on these locks. That would be, for example, a suitable thing to do. At least if, as long as you, yeah, should probably do. So that would be a possible version. Well, the other thing that you buy yourself into is that there's, of course, this issue of having a global clock, which you need to access on each and every write during transactions. So, yeah, since that is a thing that all the transactions access, and you have only the notion of one global counter in that sense, this is could be kind of a bottleneck for your system. So, well, there might be contention on that. And, well, we have seen examples for how to deal with that. I don't know whether you have been in that part of the tutorial so far, but there's this bumper allocation thing, for example, and that is essentially just a counter which is increased step by step, and well, that is almost exactly what the global clock also is. So you can try to realize that in the same way as the bumper allocator. And you maybe have already seen the performance issues that arise with the particular approaches to optimizing that. So, yeah. Same thing goes here for the global clock. Yeah. I think that is something that I don't want to focus on too much anymore, because I think we've optimized the software transactional memory out of the tutorial so far, so this is not issues that I want to talk too much about. Well, the only thing that remains open now is what to do about the non-transactional memory resources. So there's the issue of well, at some point you might want to have things like storage involved, or condition variables, volatile accesses to memory parts that might change unexpectedly or behave somehow weirdly, the general issue of input and output. These are concepts that don't fit into transactional memory at all. So the question still is, what do you do in these software transactional memories for these things? So there's a few ways of dealing with that. So you could go the strict way in completely prohibiting things like I/O. This would be kind of a puristic approach to the whole thing, and there are approaches out there who try to enforce that by giving you compiler errors in environments or well, in situations where you can't guarantee that there's no input-output condition variable storage or whatever involved. So that is one approach to it. And well, there's the other one of try to execute it in the sense that hoping that, for example, the IO operations don't actually really occur during a runtime. And in case that you then in the end actually reach such an IO, you would abort and either throw some exception or try to go some different path or whatever you might do in that way. So it's kind of a pragmatic approach there. Then there's the idea of trying to execute it with priority in that sense. So if you encounter any instructions on the way that you cannot undo or roll back, this is usually a very strong criteria that if you progress by executing these instructions, then you should make sure that you don't have to roll back at some point. That's so that you never have to undo. So you can kind of give that particular transaction then priority against all other transactions, or even try to do something like a global lock for the ones where you decide that there's that you're gonna irrevocably execute it. So that is also an approach that is used out there. And then there's the last point of trying to integrate the effects that that hinder a transaction in running, for example, by buffering write accesses to a file into some data structure, which is only then returned by the transaction to be immediately after executed in a non-transactional environment. So, you don't really get the store to the file then as part of the transaction, but at least you get the effect of what should have happened and can then try to organize some way of accessing this side effect based instruction. So, that is, for example, what you can do. Also for things like output to the console or something, you might collect all the messages that you're going to output also in some kind of buffer. You know that from these error management systems where you have an error logger or something, and then put them to the output stream after you have done the transaction. So these are ways of dealing with the non-transactional parts of algorithms. So, usually if you think about the algorithms for which you would like to have transactional behavior, I would say a lot of applications require only for example, do an update in which you have several steps where you destroy some kind of invariant, which you then establish later on when you complete your transaction. And this is usually something that is not overly depending on some non-transactional resource, but probably usually a memory-based thing. And in that sense, you will probably in most cases be able to still just use transactional memory for that. So the other approach that I wanted to show you, which is quite fascinating, is this hardware transactional memory idea. So this came up actually for quite some time now, but it has been quite tricky to implement in actual hardware. So the kind of most accessible version that is out there that we can use is probably in server or laptop processors. That is an implementation that has made it to actual machines somewhere around 2014-15, has been disabled and enabled once in a while, depending on how many bugs have been detected in the actual hardware implementations. But that is kind of the point in time where kind of mainstream architectures have started to make use of hardware transactional memory. So as kind of a general concept, hardware transactional memory is a pretty hard thing to actually really realize. So what you instead, or what the manufacturers have focused on instead, is usually the idea of transactions with a limited size. So you can implement them with a reasonable amount of logic on your chip. So that is the way that that the hardware manufacturers were going. So what they usually do is they add some logic to keep track of read and write sets as special purpose hardware extensions, and usually implement the conflict detection in an eager way by making use of cache. So there's several implementations out there for Intel architectures, but also for I think the power series and the set. Well, some kind of high performance architectures that have support for hardware transactional memory, and they usually decide to choose the cache for realizing this conflict detection, since there is already some kind of protocol in place where you try to identify whether there's a conflict in writing to particular memory addresses. And they differ in the kind of the location where they actually have anchored their transactional memory concept. So there's usually a hierarchy of caches in your systems, and for the more simpler implementations, you have transactional memory support just in level one cache, and in the more sophisticated versions, you have not even an implementation in, for example, level 2 cache, but distributed over the hierarchies of your cache, with a lot of communication concerning transactions going on there. And we'll see how that works in the simple implementation later on. So what you do then is that you attach the transaction information to your cache lines and try to detect when there's communication concerning that particular cache line, whether there's a conflict, by checking whether the cache line is part of your transaction, for example. And you then usually abort the transaction if you encountered an address that is marked as part of your transaction being queried or written to, depending on your local state. So since all these approaches are somehow limited in terms of size of the transaction, there might be the risk of the since we could program an arbitrarily large transaction with just these atomic blocks, that the hardware is not able to actually fulfill all the needs that would be necessary for that particular transaction. So usually what you do is you combine these limited implementations of transactional memory with an implementation of software transactional memory that would chip in the case that the hardware-based version fails when usually either the system realizes that there's, for example, not enough space in the cache left to implement this transaction, or you repeatedly fail to commit your transaction with the transactional memory approach. So usually there's hybrids out there between hardware transactional memory and software transactional memory. So in a similar way as we have seen for the software transactional memory, you can realize an approach to hardware transactional memory by explicitly equipping your program with the necessary callbacks to organize your transactional memory, like some kind of start transaction, commit transaction, read and write primitives. However, this requires kind of a duplicated transaction set for a lot of instructions out there, which would increase your processor's API. And also, this means that the code that is out there that is so far not transactional in that sense still uses the old API, so it's unclear how to mix that with a new transactional code. So this is an approach that has not found its way into the systems that I know so far. Instead, what most of the approaches do is this way of implicit transactional memory, in the sense that you realize your transaction by just marking a beginning of a transaction and an end, and implicitly all the instructions that are used in between are supposed to be carried out in a transactional way. Usually also these systems are realized in a way that could be implemented in a way that if your system does not support transactional memory yet, you could have some kind of dummy query in the beginning, where you then fork to your fallback implementation by default, so that you could just compile your program against this API of transactional memory, and depending on the capabilities of your hardware, this would branch to either the hardware supported transactional memory or immediately go into the software part. So, yeah. Then, the approaches that have competed with each other for the kind of mainstream market has been the one from AMD that has has followed an approach where you would explicitly have to move the data from the non-transactional memory into transaction memory and back, and was kind of intended to provide kind of a little bit larger atomic operations as the ones that we have seen as basic blocks for lock-free programming. I think that although this approach was published, it has never seen actual hardware implementation. Instead, what we have seen is the implementation called TSX or what is it? RTM, I think they call it at some places. So it depends on whether you use marketing speech or technician speech. So this is an approach that has finally arrived in actual mainstream hardware in, well, around August 2014. With, I think, a few months later being deactivated via microcode update due to some buggy implementations, and a few iterations later, I think, they have come to a state where you can actually use it now, so it's actually not so long that this is out there. Also, I think this is this is a feature that you will probably not find on everyone's laptop, for example. I think only the very top-notch variants usually get that feature, so you might not be able to directly test these things on your particular laptop. But I think in terms of desktop and server processes, the middle class and the higher class should usually have these features by now. So maybe if you have a stationary computer somewhere or access to some server, you can still try the benefits of hardware transactional memory. So this variant is one which is implicitly transactional. So you usually see ordinary instructions in between some kind of start and commit instruction. And it usually tracks the read and write sets for a transaction at the cache line level, so the thing that we have seen outlined already a little bit before, and works by setting up a backup of the system state at the beginning of the transaction by backing up, I think, the most important CPU registers, and well, being able to restore that in case of an abort of a transaction. And in order to support things like nested transactions, there's a counter facility that can keep track of how many starts of transactions have been passed so far, and well, decreases the counter in case that a commit is encountered. So that way, nested transactions can still be processed. And well, since this is a restricted or limited approach, depending on the actual state of your system, how much space there is still left in your cache, for example, if you use partition cache, then this might shrink quite a considerable amount, or depending on the actual program that you run, you might have so many nested transactions that you, in the end, run out of space in your cache in order to carry out your complete transaction. In that case, this would just abort due to lack of resources. And in case of these nested transactions, this would mean that the outermost transaction would actually fail. So there's no notion of kind of intermediate transactions being able to be rolled back to be tried again at a later time. So as soon as you encounter an abort, you abort everything that is nested with respect to transactions. So in order to make use of hardware transactional memory, there's actually two approaches to that. There's the kind of general restricted transactional memory with your usual start and commit of a transaction. Then there's a more specialized version called hardware lock elision, and we will have a look on both of them. So first of all, the general version with a restricted transactional memory. So this is done by this backup register set in order to, in the beginning of the outermost transaction, being able to get a snapshot of the current system state So that's what you need the backup register set for. Also, you will then start initializing the nesting counter with 1 and will continually increase and decrease depending on how many start and commit instructions you actually happen to see during the execution of the program. Then there's the need for tracking the read and write sets of your transaction, and that is usually done by introducing an extra bit for each of the catch lines in order to mark whether they have been part of the transaction or not. So as soon as you touch any of any address during the run of a transaction, you will flag the according cache line with that particular flag and only clear them as in the process of either committing or aborting. So you will gather a lot of flagged cache lines during the run. This also means, of course, that in case that you, for example, have only used addresses for reading, for example, and you your cache starts to fill up, you can not start just evicting cache lines, which you would have usually done in the situations of an ordinary algorithm, since you can't really drop the information that that particular cache line has been part of the transaction. So as soon as you have touched any address during the transaction, you have to keep that information in the transaction, in the cache. So that is one of the reasons why you can actually run out of resources during your transaction, since you have only limited space available for cache lines. And this also gives you an idea of how powerful this implementation is in comparison to implementations where you have these deeper nesting in your cache, like level 2 or even level 3 based transactional memory things. So there's orders of magnitude in the size of the cache for that. So yeah. Anyway, this can be done as an augmentation of the kind of abstract interface that we have already seen before. So since this is based on the Intel architecture, you will notice that this is the version of the architecture without invalidate buffer, and so buffer is meant to be this FIFO buffer, so TSO architecture. And with respect to what has changed to before, well, we introduced, of course, the notion of cache lines being part of a transaction. So there's this column for the transaction bit attached to each of the cache lines. And then there's the facility for taking a snapshot of the system in at the start of a transaction. So you need a register bank and a nesting counter. And this is just attached somewhere next to the CPU. Needs to be filled with the register, so direct connection is makes sense. So, apart from that, you of course need some logic to actually use these facilities. So that is provided with a few instructions that are added to the system. So you get, for example, an instruction for starting a transition. In that case, mnemonic xbegin, which would start by incrementing the nesting counter C. And in case that the counter has been 0 before, well, this usually is the sign of, well, now we start a fresh transaction without any without any surrounding transactions. So in this case, we will have to do the system snapshot by backing up the registers. And what usually also happens is that you clear the store buffer from everything that has happened before the transactions in order to be able to re-roll everything to that particular state. So you usually also flush the buffer. So then what happens is that we have said that this is a transparent solution to the system, so you usually don't see any particularly modified instruction set apart from these very few instructions begin and end. So this means that if you hit other read or write accesses after you have started a transaction, the interpretation of these instructions now changes to the transactional interpretation, which means that if I read or write to any address, I do the usual work for fetching the appropriate cache lines, but as soon as I access them, I also set, or as soon as I have them in my cache, I also set the according cache line to not the cache line, the bit for the transaction for that particular cache line. So step by step, I will gather my transaction flag for the cache lines in my cache. This is in order to track the read and write sets of our transaction, of course. The question is now, how do I do conflict detection? And that is a thing for which the usual MESI protocol is kind of reused in the sense that usually the other CPUs that that are competing with you for the access to memory, as soon as they are interested in writing to a memory address, they usually issue an invalidation request as a MESI message on the shared bus. So, just realized there's still some kind of old relict in there, so invalidate queue is not a thing in Intel. So if there is an invalidate message that reaches your cache, and if it is targeting a cache line that is marked as part of your transaction, this usually means that there is the intent of writing to a cache line which you have either read or modified during your transaction. This is usually a cause for you to abort your current transaction. So that is what then happens. So this will lead to an abort. The other cause for aborting a transition would be if you happened to have modified a cache line during your transaction, thus a cache line with M and T flag being being marked as such, and if another transaction try or well doesn't necessarily need to be a transaction. Could also be legacy code. If another actor is interested in reading the current value of that thing and you have a modified version in your cache, then, well, the whole system is threatened with running out of sync, or, well, you risk kind of giving out a modified value for which you don't know whether you will actually succeed in your transaction, and this is both things that you don't want to have. So in those cases, usually you also abort your transaction. So these are the two causes for aborting transactions with an external event as an as a trigger. Then there's also the notion of the transaction itself being able to abort when it has realized that it can't possibly ever reach a consistent state again, for example, and this would be done by an explicit abort instruction. So that is also a thing that is offered from the instruction set. And this usually operates by, well, clearing all the T flags away from the cache, while also invalidating the cache lines that have been also modified. It will also restore the CPU registers to the version that has been been the state of the system at the beginning of the transaction, and reset the nesting counter to zero. Yes, please. I have that, I think, on the next slide. No, it's not directly restored in that sense, but I have not told you everything about xbegin, because that usually takes as an argument another address which can be used in order to branch to when the transaction is aborted. So, yeah, there is a means of controlling where you end up, but it's not by restoring the program counter, but by communication. So then there's the ordinary commit, which is realized with this xend instruction, which decrements the nesting counter, and in case that it hits zero, this will clear all the T flags and flush the store buffer. So, so that you get all your effects into the ordinary state, and then can continue with common MESI protocol without any transactional involvement. So this way you map your transactional memory into an arbitrary environment which can still use the memory in non-transactional fashion, and as soon as external accesses, non-transactional accesses to memory happens, you even get your transactions cancelled, thus there's even no unwanted interference between the non-transactional accesses and the transactions. Let me try to get that right. The situation is you have two transactions and they collide with each other, one trying to access something that the other already has accessed. So what's your question?
The question is, if I have multiple transactions from the same CPU, I need to know which transaction is the where the restored CPU registers are stored, because if there are two transactions, both of them have like certain bags.
I'm not so sure whether you can do something like that. Maybe you can, but then this would not suffice for keeping track of the several states of the things. I'm not sure. I would assume that you can't, but actually I don't really know. So maybe I would have to check. I don't want to go into some direction that I don't really know. But the thing is that so far I have not encountered any mentioning of several transactions in one CPU. I don't know. I would have to check. Okay. So. To complete the information about these things, the transaction start instruction has sees multiple use in that sense. So this xbegin usually acts as the starting point of your transaction. It is given an address when it started that allows you to configure the continuation point where when the transaction fails, control is dispatched to. So that is a parameter for this xbegin thing, but this doesn't doesn't have any effect during the initial execution of this xbegin so far, because this just starts the transaction and this snapshot of the registers and modification of the counter. So in principle, it just skips to the next instruction behind this xbegin. Then there's the situation where your transaction at some point has failed, either by an external event or by an actual abort being used. This would mean that control is somehow reverted back to this xbegin, and now this continuation address plays a role, because that determines where the execution is dispatched from this xbegin. Also, in case that the transaction is rolled back, you will find an error code in a specified register, particularly this EAX, which will tell you the reason for the abort. So this can be either manually aborted with a particular error code, or running out of resources, or external conflict, or whatever you might imagine. You can read that from the EAX thing. The XEND, just commits a transaction started by the most recent XBegin. The XABORT aborts the whole transaction with an error code that you can then extract from the EAX, and then there's the XTEST that tells you about whether you are currently running in transactional environment or not. So this is the kind of processor API, how to use that. So this is usually made accessible to you in form of some library function that you can call in your program, which is this xbegin with an underscore, and this is usually implemented in the following way. So this xbegin, of course, is kind of the central facility in there. So this is configured with a particular label as continuation address, which happens to be the label of exactly the next line. So in the form of that particular library function, you get dispatched to the same location as the usual fall through would also go to. So there's no deviation in control flow if you use this transactional memory facilities by means of this xbegin function. In order to disambiguate between the case where your transaction has succeeded or failed, what instead is done is that the status register, this EAX thing that is written by the xbegin, contains the status code of the transaction start instruction, and this is usually filled with the abort message or the abort error code, or if everything has run smoothly, with the constant that is given here, which is not a valid error code by any means. So in the end, what happens is that the contents of EAX is moved to the return value of this function, and then returned from the call to xbegin, so that you can start evaluating this thing in your program, so that you can decide whether you still found this. It's actually a minus one in that sense. Whether this is the initial value or some error code the case that the transaction has failed. So the usual usage pattern for something like that would be in a high-level language, something like this, where you start to initialize your transaction with an xbegin. And in case that the transaction has succeeded, this will return this well-known value, minus 1, which is, well, in that case, just an abbreviation for the constant xbegin started. And if that has been returned by your library call, you can then start issuing the transactional memory code, well, so the thing that you want to have within the transaction. And then, in the end, you will terminate that with a call to xend, which would basically just wrap to this xend instruction. So there's not too much that you can configure for this xend. In the case that your transaction has not succeeded, usually this comparison will go wrong, so you will usually be dispatched in this area where well, this is kind of the callback for the transaction having failed in that sense. So you might wonder, well, what should I do in that place when my transaction has failed? Am I screwed then? So what to do about this? You are supposed to provide some kind of fallback code. So what can you do in that situation? So in principle, what you're interested in when you're programming or when you're trying to implement such thing like an atomic block is you're interested in some kind of transactional code like this one over here. And no matter whether you get the chance to run that with hardware support or some way around that, you want that to be executed at some point. However, if you specify it like this, this will have several problems in that sense. So if you do it like this, then imagine that you will concurrently run this piece of code with itself. Then, for example, if you reach this non-transactional part over here with both of the approaches, since you have found some kind of conflict between those, then as soon as you are in this part of the code, you will of course start racing the other instance of that algorithm, and both will compete for this data thing, for example. So yeah, that is something which is, of course, the whole point was to not race yourself. Also, the other thing is that even if only one of the two transactions has actually failed and the other one still is within transactional code, you still race the transactional version with whatever you've done here. So you might not want to do something like that. So instead, what you would like to do is to ensure that the fallback path of your transaction is actually also executed in an atomic way. Let's see how to do that. Usually, well, I don't know about you, but I'm not so particularly creative, so I stick to the things that I know, and that's introducing mutex mutexes. So that is something I know for mutual exclusion and guaranteeing critical sections to be exclusive. So what I could do, for example, is then surround my fallback code with semaphore protected wait and signal. So this for example makes sure that if you have two concurrent fallback codes, that they won't have any races in their critical section. However, this is still not making sure that if the other the other process is currently within its transaction, that there's no interference between those two parts. So the fallback code might still be somehow in conflict with the transaction. So what you then do is kind of trick. I don't know whether you have paid attention to the code. So there was an empty line over here, which I have filled now. So what you usually do is you create a dependency between the transaction and the semaphore itself by including the semaphore's counter into the read set of your transaction. And you can do that with the statement from over here. So what you do is you manually add that if the semaphore is currently in use, then you would abort your transaction, and whenever later on the semaphore is acquired by some other process, the its mutex or well not its its counter variable is still within the read set of the transaction, marked with a transaction flag. So as soon as the wait is picking up the lock by incrementing the mutex, you will get an invalidation request sent to the transaction, which will lead for the transaction to actually fail. I think you can still construct some harmful examples when you don't have this dependency on the mutex in that sense, but I would like to maybe do that in offline. It's quite extensive to have these examples being drawn. But I think you can create an example that will lead to an actual conflict. So particularly you well, maybe not now, but that way you can somehow connect these two, the fallback branch and the main transaction, with each other, based on keeping the mutex in the read set of the transaction. So we can have a look at what happens for two runs through transactions. So you will notice that there's an example here for that, or both of the examples that have X begins, so both of them do actually use transactional memory and conclude with X end, and well, they're essentially the same algorithms, but for purpose of keeping the example a little bit more concise, I have removed the status container T from the second example. Since it's a local variable, it is local to that particular thread anyway, and the example is arranged in a way that the return value of X begin does not play a role in that in the second part. But anyway, how do these things work together? So this will operate with the so far known MESI protocol again, but with now an additional extra bit T added to the cache line states. So maybe let's start with the given initial values. So for CPU A, we have the D as exclusive 5. And T is exclusive 0. while for CPU B we have D being invalid. So far the stores are empty at the beginning. So what happens then is that we first begin with the thread A's X begin, which will perform a snapshot of the system, which we don't reflect in our happened before diagram so far. There's the status of the of whether the transaction has started or not, which is given back into T. So this is usually in the beginning, this is that the transaction has succeeded to be created. So this will be this minus one value, which will then reach the store buffer. And in our case, we immediately communicate that to the cache line for T, such that we get modified minus one in there, and this terminates. So the X begin in the other case will also do a snapshot of its current of its current state, and also flag that the transaction has started, but the return value here is ignored, thus thrown away, and we don't have any container modeled here for that thing. So this does not have any particular effect for our diagram. Then we can do, for example, this modification of the data thing, like here. So this is a read access to the store thing, which I have just put here as this D thing. So this is the line that is reached in there. So we just read this 5 thing into temp. This doesn't change anything on the state of the transaction. Oh, silly me, I completely forgot we have started the transition already, and we said that we would augment every accessed cache line with T. So this is actually TM in that particular state. So of course you have all seen that and would have reminded me in a few instructions later. Anyway, so this is part of the transaction now. Same goes for this thing over here. This is also part of the transaction now. So although reading on an exclusive thing has in the past not done any change to the cache line, now we flag that this is part of the transaction, since it is in the read set of the transaction. So let's check the other thing over here, which is another read on the other side. So same thing. We try to read from this address D, which is locally invalid. So what's done is, well, we issue a read request. So this reaches this thing over here. And yeah, what's happening now? A read to transaction line. Is that harmful? So it's not necessarily, only if it's modified. So what instead is then happening is it's still part of the transaction, but it's now shared. It's still 5 and will be responded to the other thread, which then keeps that as transactional, shared 5, and will store this 5 in its TMP thing, which is probably a register or something. So what happens then is that the threads will both try to perform their updates on the memory thing. So we will increment this, or we will store some new value into data. So this is, well, I haven't specified what value actually is in that case. So what is the unknown value? That's usually 42. So like that. We will now store that, which will end up in an entry in the store buffer, which will say that D is now 42 plus value is 47. So that is still necessary to be communicated to the cache line for D. And yeah, with that, this is already terminated. And remember, store buffers, you can't do too much about when they are supposed to be written to the actual cache line. You only can enforce that with barriers. So since there's no barriers so far, we will just switch over to the other side, where there's the same transaction now going on, and this will enter the data thing, which is coincidentally also 47, into the store buffer, and by some miracle, this thing now tries to actually perform its update, resulting in an invalidate or even a read invalidate, I think it should be, because it's invalid so far, so that is a read invalidate, and we'll have a read response, of course, and an invalidate acknowledged. So this will lead to shared. Oh no, it's not in. It has been modified already as shared, so there's no such thing as these. Sorry, thinking too much without looking. So this has been already over there. So we issue just an invalidation request, which will be acknowledged by the other peer. And yeah, the thing is, I have an invalidate request reaching my cache. And particularly, it is targeted at a cache line that is part of the transaction. There is a transaction flag attached to that. So this usually means that my transaction has read from something which is now rewritten before my transaction has committed. So this is a worst-case scenario. So what will happen is the abort will be issued, which means that the transactions has to be the transaction has to be rolled back, meaning that all the cache lines with T are now checked for whether they are in modified or shared state. This one is in modified state, for example, so this is gonna be invalidated even. So you cannot rely on that information to be correct anymore. Also, the line for D, for example, would in principle be just shared, so not particularly outdated. So you could just remove the T flag from that. However, this was the line which was targeted with invalidation. So we also have to drop information about that. Also, when we abort a transaction, we will then have to clear the store buffer, because that's just transactions interactions that are stored in there. So we will remove the update on D from the store buffer and have a clean store buffer once again. So a lot happening for thread A. Thread B, however, just receives the invalidation acknowledgement, meaning that it will then continue to modify its value like that, thus clearing the store buffer, and in the end, with the XEND, make sure that the store buffer is empty, which it is, and then just is able to remove whatever has been marked as transactional, like this. So we will transition into ordinary state where the transaction is terminated. We don't need to keep track of read or write sets anymore, so we clear away every transaction thing that we see and be done with that. On the other side, thread A has been aborted. So what happens is then implicitly this xbegin now has the semantic that continuation is happening at the address specified. For the version that we see over here, we know that this is just the next instruction in line, which will then make sure that the now updated error message is communicated to T. So T is now the abortion error code instead of the other thing before. So what is happening here is we actually write to T. Since we don't have an... so this is going in there, like T is to be modified with... I don't know what the actual code is there, but let's just do such a symbol in there. So in practice, that's something like, I don't know, some complicated bit mask that is set for the error code. However, we want to write that as a new value for T. So T is now invalid, so we need to somehow obtain a suitable cache line for that. So we have to issue a clean, or we have to request a clean version of that from whoever has a clean version of that. And since this has been a local variable, this will usually be no one else but the memory. So we communicate here with the memory, which will then provide us with the former state of that thing, which was probably something I don't know, because we have created that variable at that point, only declared that here. So this is whatever the memory has had at that memory position over here. But in the end, we will end up with a now transactionally modified... well, is that actually the case? No, I think we are outside of the transaction now, because we are in the aborting case, so there's actually no T. So it's just modified with the error code, which is... well, I don't know what it is, but it's some value. Okay, so that is what usually happens in these systems, at least for one of these, for one of the sequences of instruction that we fold with each other here. So, maybe just a few hints of what happens now. What you've seen is this particular pattern for implementing code that is there for protecting critical areas. And you have seen something like that for mutices already. So, you are probably quite used to the way how to interact with mutices, and also you might have a lot of legacy code which you want to outfit with our new fancy hardware supported transactional memory. So what you can do is you can try to extract from this usage pattern how you would usually try to protect your critical sections that you have used here and here, and try to pull out all the organizational stuff that is around that into library code. And that is what you can do in a similar fashion as you have had an interface for mutices, with something I called lock and unlock over here, and only having to mention the code for the critical section once here in the middle. And you can do so by just pulling out this part and this part from the left hand side and putting it into the lock part, as well as the part for terminating the critical section and putting it in the unlock code. So you're pulling out those sections of code and bundle them by their actual purpose, like locking or unlocking a section. And that way you create a similar interface to transactional memory as you had for your common semaphore-based mutexes. And if you do something like that, the approach is then called lock elision, or you call the lock elided in that sense. Because what you do is you try to actually acquire the lock only in the second step, and in the first step you try to work in a similar way without actually really taking the lock. So you consider that lock as not actually being taken, however, with the intention of if something goes wrong, you still do that. And what that gives you compared to your approach with standard locks is that the part that is predominantly tried to be executed is the one for the transactional memory, which is one that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to communicate with all other CPUs on your system. You don't have to lock down the cache in order to perform lock-free algorithm to implement your semaphore access. Instead, all you do is kind of local changes to your CPU, where you just do a snapshot of your registers and introduce transactions. And as long as you don't get any conflicting accesses, your synchronization means have been completely local to your CPU. Thus, negating all need for communicating with other CPUs until, of course, you reach the point where you actually get a conflicting access, where you then revert back to your old solution with an actual lock. And this is a thing that sparked the idea of providing even hardware support for that with hardware lock elision. That's how it's called. Which means that there's special hardware support introduced for that particular pattern, where you don't have to rely on your on this sequence of having to start your transaction manually and then still perform your old mutex code, but instead make the usage of mutexes explicit on the assembly level by preceding the instructions that take up the or well acquire the lock or release it with these prefixes x acquire and x release, which will implicitly then do all the setup for the transactional memory for you. And this will mean that compared to your former architecture, what the system will do for you is it will keep track of the elided locks in the forms of the addresses of the counter variables on which your lock is based in a particular space in your CPU, and it will apart from starting the transaction memory, it will then keep lookout for other accesses to other write accesses to the elided locks, and in case that there's something like that started, then it will revert the transaction to its former self. So that is the general idea of this lock elision thing. Turns out that I have not found major current libraries that really have tried to go that way. So far as I know, there's no real system that really makes use of that hardware technique, at least yet. Usually they instead resort to the usual x begin x end thing. So maybe that is not so interesting. You might be itching for how can I use transactional memory. So yeah, there's actual currently implementations for that out there. For example, GCC offers you experimental support for transactional memory by this keyword of transaction atomic, which is a keyword which can be followed by a block in the way as our atomic has been working. So with that, you can already make use of transactional memory, at least if you have included your lib for the transactional memory. And this has also the advantage compared to explicit access to hardware transactional memory, that on systems where there is transactional memory available in hardware implementation, it will resort to that. And on systems where there's no TSX, and of course for the fallback part, it will resort to an own implementation of software transactional memory. So this makes life quite quite nice for you. Also, you should note that apart from just an experimental feature on a particular compiler, there's also efforts to actually standardize the way that transactional blocks are added to C++ in the upcoming standard of C++, with these keywords synchronized or atomic, and well, depending on the exact semantics that you want to have for that block, this atomic whatever comes after that. So there's efforts to bring that to mainstream compilers as a standard. Also other systems that are kind of, for example, virtual machine based, like the Java virtual machine, the transactional memory support slowly dribbles into the implementations of these VMs. So for example, for the implementation of synchronized, so the monitors of OpenJDK, you can also activate support for transactional memory via virtual machine parameter, for example. Hardware lock collision, unluckily, I have not found too many spots where they're actually used. There has been an experimental adaptation of the pthreads library that enables the use of hardware lock collision, but I think it has been implemented with the general purpose instructions instead of the X-acquire, X-release ones, so I'm not so sure how much use that will be in future. So yeah, so much about practical implementations of these systems. With the transactional memory, we will kind of come to a conclusion for the building blocks for concurrent constructs in programming languages. I will at some point maybe come back to the issue of communicating in concurrent programs when we reach the part of coroutines and continuations, but since I need some other prerequisites for that, I will postpone that for a little bit later when we have passed the introduction into that particular programming language. So that's so far all for concurrent systems. Next time we will continue with function dispatching, I think. So that's all for transactional memory. I hope that you have kind of an impression of what's going on at that front at the moment. And I think we'll see us again next week. Thank you.